hour number two of the Bible study. I'm Chuck Rather. It's the Ask the Pastor Hour, the open phone hour. Make the program available to you for phone calls on any subject as it pertains to religion, church, faith, or the Bible. I'm going to have to forgive me because I have been on vacation. If I touch on something that was discussed by Paul Clayton and his guests, that's just too bad. That's the kind of sensitive guy I am. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our guest in this hour is the president of the LCMS Foundation. The foundation handles financial affairs for the 2.5 million member church body, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He's the, you know, they don't let me anywhere near the money anywhere. So I have no way of identifying with President Tom Reese's duties, but we know that he's a trustworthy guy, so we give him our money, and he sees to it that all is well. How are things in this bad economy for a person who is in the business of handling money on behalf of a church body?
Well, that's a great question. We obviously have had better years when it comes to investment returns.
That's what we call putting the best construction on it.
That's right. That's right. Trusts and annuities and endowments that are managed at the foundation is only a part of what we do, but it's a big part and it's an important part. We are being tested in terms of what does it mean to be in a long-term investment strategy. And as far as that's concerned, when we have a really, really very tough year, a 50-year maybe tough year, like 2008 was, and to see that the program is still performing according to the way it was designed, and we believe in the long run is going to perform very well and still provide returns over the long run that are better than putting it in a bank savings account or something of that nature, not to knock that, but that's what our objective is. We feel pretty good about it. So, and of course, the market performs in cycles and has been showing some signs of life in March, and that's always pretty exciting as well.
Now, how many years for you at the foundation?
5 years. April 1st was my 5-year anniversary.
And prior to that, were you in the parish?
I had been, yes, I was. Just immediately prior to that, I was serving as the chief financial officer at one of the LCMS's colleges, or universities, I should say, and that was Concordia University in St. Paul, Minnesota. Altogether have about 12 years of parish experience myself, 2 as an assistant pastor and 10 as a senior pastor at a wonderful place in Minnesota. And 4th-generation LCMS pastor. My grandfather, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were all pastors, so it's a privilege to be a pastor.
So
in the
you
church.
Have what we call an exemplary pedigree.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
You like those big words?
Well,
the biggest ones I know. So I want to get your comment on this. I took this from the STLtoday.com website, the website for the Post-Dispatch. They have a religion, what they call civil religion blog there, where people contribute and other people respond. This was written by Sherry Tyree, special to the Post-Dispatch, and she says, President Barack Obama has accepted a highly controversial invitation from Notre Dame to speak at its May commencement ceremony, as well as receive an honorary doctorate in law. The angry reaction to this invitation has been swift and growing, each day bringing new statements from bishops, pundits, and ordinary Catholics. Bishop John Darcy, in whose diocese this event will take place, has decided to give the commencement a miss. He explains, quote, my decision is not an attack on anyone, but is in defense of the truth about human life. The Center for a Just Society supports Bishop Darcy and expounds on his position. Bishop Darcy's position is reflective of the outrage of many in the Catholic community. Their angst is understandable since Mr. Obama has pursued a strong anti-life agenda both before and after assuming the office of president. Indeed, Mr. Obama's actions are at odds with the very foundations of American law and justice, a belief that all men are created equal and that innocent human life should be protected by the state. So I'm thinking, you're just the perfect guy to speak to this because you have had parish experience. You have had experience at an LCMS university, and you now work here in St. Louis at the International Center as part of the organizational structure of the church body. You have experience on a variety of levels. When you see that there's what is called here a highly controversial debate going on about the propriety of this invitation, do you tend to react on all three of those levels, or do you tend to react on one level over the others? Let's begin there.
Well, that's a great question. I suppose I first tend to react with just like everybody does within my own frame of reference, and that is as a Christian first, lifelong Lutheran second, LCMS member third, and so the onion kind of gets unpeeled in that way. In terms of the arenas in which we dialogue, that's a really great question because there may be kind of a dialogue that takes place on a university campus that might not take place in a congregational setting, or it might. I mean, there's different ways of looking at that. So, you know, the other aspect of that is when we look at speakers that we are going to invite to be involved in dialogue, and in this case, of course, they're giving him an honorary doctorate, so that takes it another step. Must we have agreement on all points of doctrine and practice before we invite somebody to speak or not? And I guess that really we would love to entertain some calls on that subject from your listeners.
Yeah, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We certainly would like to hear from listeners as to how you view this. And the issue is this. The Roman Catholic Church is, I think, as pro-life as any ecclesiastical organization in the world. And you're not here to speak on their behalf, and you know, and I'm not asking you to. But the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is on record as being, I think, essentially, and can I say entirely, pro-life. We certainly, in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, have our disagreements, our theological disagreements with the Roman Catholic Church. But on this, we are in agreement, are we not? We have a very compelling and committed pro-life position. Wouldn't that be correct?
It is my understanding that that is absolutely correct. And beginning with the origin of life, beginning at conception, and the value of life from conception, the gift of life from God himself, and the duty and responsibility to nurture that life until God determines it's time to take it.
Now, there is, it seems to me, a difference between inviting a speaker to come onto your campus to make an address where students can attend if they want to hear what this person has to say, and inviting someone to be your commencement speaker where graduation takes place. Just speaking for Tom Reese, do you think it's appropriate if Concordia St. Paul, for example, invites a decidedly unabashed pro-choice speaker for commencement?
Well, let's just speak for Tom Reese, and I would say in that case, yes, I would think so. Commencement is a, even though it's a Christian university, commencement is a public academic exercise, and academia is, after all, the center of the exchange of ideas. And we deal with this on Christian universities all the time. What is an appropriate exchange of ideas and still the preservation of biblical values versus the exchange of ideas that would take place in a public university or a private university that is non-sectarian? Is there a difference? And certainly there is a difference. And certainly the audience and those involved would understand that the context is different here, but we still want to hear this this man speak, and we are interested in his ideas because he's the President of the United States. So put me down as a yes in terms of inviting him to speak. We have had one President of the United States speak at one of our campuses at a commencement, and that was President Bush spoke at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, when he was in office, and I'm sure we didn't agree with everything that he believed and thought, but we honored that as well.
So I guess my final question is, in your thinking, while I guess we all have to settle on the question of how committed is our institution, whatever, pick your institution, whether it's Notre Dame or whether it's Concordia St. Paul or whatever it is, how committed is the institution to a pro-life position, for example? And can that be trumped by the magnitude of the prestige of the person that you're inviting? So Barack Obama has a distinctly pro-choice position. Notre Dame has a distinctly pro-life position, but this, after all, is the President of the United States. It is perhaps as prestigious an office as one can have in the civil realm. Does that prestige trump whatever philosophical or ethical differences might exist in other arenas?
Yeah, and I guess I would hate to use the word Trump. I think it what it does is there's two different contexts there, and there's certainly two very important different belief systems. But it is being presented in a university setting where there is definitely that free exchange of ideas. And so I guess I wouldn't say that it trumps it. I would say that it certainly doesn't hurt that the President of the United States brings that kind of prestige. And there may be others who are pro-choice or even pro-abortion. I don't know that there's a lot of folks that are pro-abortion, but pro-choice, who may not be appropriate as speakers because they don't have other qualifications that might make them good commencement speakers.
So when this hit the news, what did you think? Did you think, well, I'm glad it's not happening here in at my doorstep, or intellectually, did you have a reaction?
No, I had a pretty much of a positive reaction to it. I didn't have the thinking that I'm glad it's not happening at the institution that I'm at, because controversy at an institution is not always a bad thing. And if we think that it is, then we're going to be living in a pretty tight box. But I thought it was a good... another good step that Notre Dame was going to have him speak, and that he was going to speak, and that it kind of raised again the issue for a public policy conversation as well as a spiritual conversation on the whole area of abortion and of life. It is interesting to me that the Catholic bishops and others who have reacted to this have focused on that one aspect of Barack Obama's policy. And there may be other aspects that are as important that should receive some attention as well.
All right, let's take up another subject here. As Lent is winding down now, we are in Holy Week, and by this time next week, we'll be in the Easter season. The Lenten season will have come to a conclusion. This is a person who also made a post on the stltoday.com civil religion website. Her name is Pamela Dolan, and she says, I was at a dinner party once listening to a woman discuss her family's preparations for Lent. She talked about how the family got together for a meeting and discussed what their Lenten observances would be and how they could support one another's choices. I was about to interrupt, eager to commend my friend for her family's seriousness and piety, when she continued, quote, my husband always gives up desserts. And you know, he loses 6 or 7 pounds every time. It's just so great, unquote. She continues, I decided to hold my tongue. Lent is almost over, and it hasn't been a major topic of discussion on this blog, the STL Today blog, so I thought I'd throw it out there for your consideration. If you're a Christian, is Lent a meaningful time of year for you? Do you follow customs you learned as a child, like giving up chocolate, or have you found other ways to make this time an opportunity for transformation? Do you find a correlation between how deeply you observe Lent and how joyful your Easter celebration is? Let's just go through those questions from your perspective, Pastor Reese, and take them one at a time. Her first question is, if you're a Christian, is Lent a meaningful time of year for you? Now, let's go beyond the assumptions. You work for a church body. You have been a parish pastor. I know, I already know that the answer to this is yes, but I need you to explain that to me.
Well, as far as Lent as a season of the church year, we certainly think it's a very meaningful season. I enjoy the fact that it begins with worship on Ash Wednesday, and we intentionally enter into the season knowing that we're going to observe this 40-day period following Christ to the cross. I like the liturgical aspects of Lent. I like the scripture readings. I like the way that we follow him in the gospel. He has opposition to his going to Jerusalem, and then later goes to Jerusalem, and those things which he spoke about as part of his important salvation mission are completed on the cross on Good Friday. Those kinds of things are just wonderful for me as an individual, and I think for our church and our congregations in general. One thing I've never been, and I always admire people who are, and I listen to them and I try to probe on that when I run into those folks. I've never been really a big one for spiritual disciplines, and I kind of envy people that are. There's certain things that they do in their spiritual practice that are meaningful to them. If it's giving up something, that's fine. The illustration that was used in your comments there or in the comments from the blog seem frivolous, yes, but there are other folks who really seriously undertake some of these spiritual disciplines, and they are wonderful practices and meaningful practices for them. And so I think if it helps enhance the Lenten experience, I don't personally have never felt the need for that, but as I said, I find my Lenten experience in the liturgical readings, in the idea of the beginning and the follow-through, following Christ to the cross. But others may find some value in those spiritual disciplines, and I admire that.
The writer here, Pamela Dolan, titled this this part of the blog, Lent, self-improvement or transformation. In her question here, she says, do you follow customs you learned as a child, or have you found other ways to make this an opportunity for transformation? What does the word transformation mean to you in the context of Lent?
Well, it certainly is an ongoing transformational experience to have this special liturgical time of the year when we focus on our need for Christ's forgiveness, our own sinful condition, and that's how Lent begins, of course, on Ash Wednesday with the imposition of ashes and the focus on those readings that are part of the liturgy. And we're not necessarily a one-time transformation, but an ongoing transformation that's part of the Christian life, and I think Lent adds to that as well.
And she says, do you find a correlation between how deeply you observe Lent and how joyful your Easter celebration is?
Yeah. Well, how deeply, if she means, again, spiritual disciplines that are intended to deepen the experience of Lent, I don't have that same feeling. I don't experience that, as I said. Lent is a seasonal thing, a liturgical thing, and a meaningful thing. But there's no way to deepen that for me personally.
Well, let's put it this way. If there were no Lenten season, if the Epiphany season just ran all the way to Easter, and all of a sudden it was Easter,
yeah,
would Easter be as compelling? Would it be as powerful for you if you hadn't gone through your Lenten meditations?
That's a really great way of looking at it, and I think, no, that's right. It wouldn't be as compelling. I think the Lenten season does add to the joy of Easter. And the completion of the whole cycle is made more meaningful in the celebration of Christ's resurrection.
The author of this post says, her name, by the way, is Pamela Dolan. She quotes a friend who has this comment about Lent. The friend says, even our heart is the ark. She's talking about the ark of the covenant, I guess. Even our heart is the ark, a place of safety and yet a place of transformation. Enclosed and tossed upon turbulent seas of sin and chaos and culture, these 40 days of Lent give us a time of growing transformation, renewing our lives from the core of our hearts. I guess she's talking about Noah's Ark there.
Mm-hmm.
Any reaction to that comparison?
I like it. I really do. I think it's a great way of expressing what Lent is all about. And different personalities are going to be prone to different kinds of experiences or practices in Lent. You know, mine is the pretty rational left side of the brain, whichever one of those sides of the brain has put us together, and male, and everything else about that. So
I can tell you're a linear kind of guy.
Yeah, there you go. There's one way to get from A to B, and that's right. But other people aren't that way, and I learn so much from them when I talk to those folks, especially fellow pastors who are wired a little differently than I am, and can maybe deepen those experiences for even a old fuddy-duddy like me to make it much more of a emotional, spiritual, and sensual experience.
So the blog concludes. Pamela says, to return to my friend at the dinner party, don't get me wrong, I'd love to lose a few pounds, and I hate to sound like a holier-than-thou zealot, but self-improvement is not really the point of this time of year. Transformation, sanctification, submission to God's will in our lives, that's the point. And then she concludes by saying, let me know what you think. So what do you think?
I love that. I just think that's great. What great observations those are for her to make. And, you know, it's not just the trivialization of giving up things for Lent, but I'm always amused of the number of people in this country and throughout the world that are so anxious to celebrate Shrove Tuesday with the carnival. And I think to myself, yep, and I bet they'll all be in church and receiving the imposition of ashes on Ash Wednesday the next day. And, of course, we know that's not the case. And yet those instances, just like Christmas in our culture, which is a post-Christian culture, there's no question about that, give us the opportunity to speak, just as this woman is, to the deeper meaning and the essential meaning of these holidays and seasons in the church year.
So I guess the word that I'm struggling with here in her observation is the word transformation.
Mm-hmm.
It suggests that having gone through the Lenten season, if one has been paying attention, one should be impacted in such a way that there is a transformation that occurs over the course of those 40 days, culminating in the celebration of the Lord's resurrection on Easter Sunday. Transformation, that's quite a... that word has quite a bit of meaning, so that if you sort of get to Easter Monday and you're pretty much the same guy as you were on Fat Tuesday,
mm-hmm.
and transformation is not apparent, then maybe something went wrong.
Yeah, I guess that's true, and I would have the same struggle as you do with transformation there, because transformation, again, for a linear thinker, we're going to take that seriously if we're going to use transformation as a word. And it's going to be complete, and it's going to be rather radical. There's going to be some major changes. To me, the repetitive cycle of year after year, season after season, decade after decade of going through the liturgical calendar, transformational, but more steadying, more of a time of where we're observing different things. And in that sense, it's good, but I don't know that I'm going to be a completely different person when it's all said and done.
You listen to the Bible study. We're interested in what you might have to say about this, or perhaps the Notre Dame controversy that's underway. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and we'll be right back.
Every Thursday, St. Anthony's Medical Center in South St. Louis County offers cholesterol testing from 8 to 11 a.m. Testing requires participants to fast for 12 hours before undergoing total cholesterol, triglycerides, high-density and low-density lipoproteins, risk ratio, and glucose testing at a cost of $30. As part of the process, a free blood pressure check will be provided. Cholesterol test results will be given at the time of testing. Screenings take place on the second floor of the Highland Education and Training Center, 10,020 Kennerly Road.
During KFUO's 85th anniversary year, we encourage your congregation to become a Church of the Week. Your church will not only be supporting the ministry of AM 850 KFUO, but you will have opportunities to tell our listeners about your congregation and ministry. Your pastor or congregational spokesperson will be featured on the morning show, and each day your church will have 5 30-second on-air announcements, plus mentions every hour throughout the week. please call us and become a KFUO Church of the Week.
That is one smelly amoeba. Learn about it next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment host, Ian Taylor.
Not all dangerous predators can be seen. One of the most dangerous predators in a drop of pond water is the amoeba Proteus. This amoeba literally terrorizes its one-celled pond mates because they can smell him coming to engulf them. Among his favorite snacks is the one-celled creatures of the genus Euplotes, but Euplotes can defend themselves. When some members of this genus smell the amoeba coming their way, they dart away to safety. Others can grow spikes to defend themselves. Some can even grow hard shells to protect themselves. All of which leaves a problem for evolution. What benefit to a predator is there in warning your prey? Evolution should have selected against the amoeba's ability to produce its unique scent, called the A factor. Now, a new discovery has revealed the amoeba's scent is really a clever design, pointing to a designer. These amoebas reproduce by splitting, so they are surrounded by clones. The A factor is just strong enough in the Proteus to identify clone mates so that they don't eat each other, but not too strong that it prevents Proteus from getting enough to eat. God sent his Son, Jesus Christ, to save us from another unseen predator, the devil. The evil in the world is warning scent of the devil's presence. God has placed many evidences within the creation that he is the creator, so that as our relatively few days on this earth flee by, we will be drawn to his Son, and believing in him, receive forgiveness and salvation from sin, death, and the devil.
For a printed transcript of today's program, visit our website at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Hi, this is Roland.
Hi, it's Buzz.
And on the next afternoon show, we'll talk to Arthur Just about a little heaven on earth. Why are we going to do what we do as we worship during this Holy Week?
It is Holy Week. We can talk the gospel. We can talk Bach. And we will talk with Dr. Uwe Simonetto about both.
Next time on the afternoon show at 3:05. Don't miss it.
Imagine living in the dark.
I lived it. Hi, I'm Sharon Lee. After losing my job, I was unable to pay my utility bills and lived in the dark. Fortunately, Ameren UE's Dollar More was there to help.
Dollar More helps Missouri residents like Sharon get the assistance they need. To give, simply check the Dollar More box on your UE bill or visit uedollarmore.com.
Experience the power to give. Support Dollar More.
Dollar More is administered by the United Way of Greater St. Louis. 100% of donations go to families in need.
Joseph should ask the pastor, pretty quiet today. You probably want the other guys back. I'm back from vacation. Well, what's this Rather guy doing back here? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you'd like to join our conversation here, we've raised a couple of subjects here. One is the meaning, or how meaningful is the season of Lent, and how that should impact our thinking as we make our way through Holy Week toward Easter Sunday. The other is the apparent inconsistency of inviting a decidedly pro-choice civic leader like President Obama to a decidedly pro-life institution like the University of Notre Dame. And now we have this. I want to raise this question with Tom Reese, president of the Foundation of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. Newsweek is, they do this all the time, seems like. Easter's coming around. Newsweek is apparently not what we would call perhaps a pro-Christian editorial magazine. And so it seems like about this time we get the weekly magazine that questions the resurrection or questions the tenets of Christianity or whatever. So Newsweek is back at it, and they're building on this American Religious Identification Survey, which came out a couple of weeks ago. And the title of their article is The End of Christian America, which is a fairly provocative title, I think you would agree.
Right.
Now let's see if we can put a face on this question. I don't know how old you are. I don't expect you to tell everybody how old you are, but I think you have children, do you not?
I do.
And how old are your children? Let's deal with that.
Oldest is 27 years old, and the youngest is 22, and I've got one in between.
So they're adults.
They're adults.
And that's pretty much exactly where I am. We have three kids, too, and they're all in their 20s. One of them's pushing 30, one of them just crossed, the 21.
Since you're 39, you had those children pretty young, I guess.
Thank you. God bless you, sir. Yep. Now, one thing that I've noticed is, as the people of that generation, you and I are in this situation now, where our children are adults. And so they are interacting with their adult peers. They have left that time where, you know, Tom, Dad, could put his foot down and, you know, you can't have the car. Then you don't have that option anymore. I guess you don't.
That's right.
And more it's apparent that people in their peer group are not Christians. Their parents are Christians. Their family, their grandparents are Christians, but they have departed the faith. And they are not announcing their atheism or their agnosticism. They've just departed the faith. Are you seeing that? I mean, maybe it's different for you. Are you hearing that from your adult children as they interact with their friends?
Well, I'll give you a couple of reactions. About a year ago, I heard a speaker named Leonard Sweet, who is a professor of theology at one of the, I think it's a Methodist college somewhere, and very, very committed evangelical Christian, and very sympathetic to, and loves the Lutheran Church as well. But he made a statement, I haven't verified it, but he made the statement that of those young people that are in our children's generation, and I forget what years he used, but as soon as he said it, I knew it was my kids. 4% are churched. And I don't know if the Newsweek article mentioned that, but that has stuck in my mind. And really, my own children, who after graduating from college and have gone off, they attend church once in a while. None of them has a church membership. This shocks me. Because I was involved in the confirmation class for each one of them. I led them through the confirmation ceremony as their pastor. And I thought that we had done a pretty good job of raising them. And frankly, what it boils down to is a sense of irrelevance of the church that is pervasive amongst that group. And second of all, not only a sense of irrelevance, but this whole idea of diversity and the old idea that all roads lead to heaven or whatever, that really scares me. So we spend a lot of time, my wife and I, witnessing to our own children, which is something we never thought we would do, not in a million years, and their generation, to try and get at and to try and listen, what is it that is different this time around? And let's face it, our generation, when we grew up in the 60s, we were not exactly a promising group either.
Again, a best construction observation. You state that in much kinder terms than I usually do.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what's going to happen this time around, and there's always that old quote about, you know, how this generation's going to the dogs, and it's just terrible what's happening, and then, well, who's the author of the quote? Socrates. You know, you've heard that one, I think, and I love that quote. But in the sense that there is no doubt in my mind, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, that we are in a post-Christian era in our culture. That's an absolute fact. And however you define that, that's up to you. But just to give you some illustrations, I read in the USA Today the other day that the Catholic Church, particularly the bishop in Detroit, was upset because the Pistons have scheduled a game in the afternoon on Good Friday. It's the first time that's ever been done. I'm surprised it hadn't been done before. And so he's objecting to that because it's another illustration of how we're in a post-Christian era. I can remember back about 8 or 10 years ago hearing sports commentators say it's not too long and we'll be playing NFL games on Christmas Day. And it's not too long ago that that was not done out of respect for the holiday of the birth of Christ. So, you know, there's definitely growing evidence that we're in a post-Christian era. And will this generation, and really our generation, Chuck, as well, because there's lots of baby boomers that have left the active involvement in the church, will there be a reversal of that? Or is spirituality taking another tack? It doesn't have to be the way we were. But Christ, as the way, the truth, and the life, is essential. And I'm very curious to see how that will play out over the next generation or two.
All right, I don't want to be guilty of prying into your personal family business. Slap my hand.
I'm pretty open. I'm 54 years old, actually, so I'm willing to admit that on radio.
What are you, obviously, you just said that you are a pastor descended from a long line of pastors.
Right.
And your kids are not churched.
That's right.
And something has happened. And I'm thinking that you probably have spent some time trying to analyze this, think it through, because you're not going to just wave goodbye to your kids in the rearview mirror and say, well, have a nice agnostic life. You're going to be dealing with it. So what are you seeing? What dynamics are you identifying that have produced this outcome?
Yeah, I'm seeing, and I don't think that they're, I'm not going to get into each one of them, but I don't think by and large that they are not Christian. I don't think they've abandoned their faith. I think that they do not sense an urgency to share that with others. And if you got them into a box and put them in a room with a group of people who had different religious and or denominational backgrounds, I would be very curious to see what they would say if there was going to be an open discussion. So I don't know that. I think, like most young people, that age of their life, that period of their life, most young people go through a sense of self-evaluation and reflection, and you know, and it's the old thing, well, when they have children of their own, then they come back to the church and they want to get the kids baptized and they get reinvolved. So the question will be, is this generation going to be like that? When they get through that period of their mid to late 20s, early 30s, will they return to something similar to the historic practices of the Christian faith that we cherish and that we have today in our lives? I don't know. I really don't. I would like to think that that will be the case, but I don't know. But I know right now with the kids that I've talked to, including my own, if you were to ask them to passionately try to persuade someone to receive Jesus Christ as their Savior, I don't think they would have the passion or the motivation to do that.
Do you think that... See, I'm trying to sort this out.
Yeah.
Because it's huge.
You bet.
It's a subject that is just enormous. You can't find all the angles. But one thing that seems to be present for them is that in their entire life, thanks to media, they've been exposed to a media Christianity which is populated in no small numbers by some strange, bizarre, outrageous characters, people who have been caught in automobiles with prostitutes, people who have had affairs with their secretaries, sexual abuse on the part of the clergy. And frankly, if I'm going to carry that label, the label of Christian, and it's going to link me to that crowd, maybe I'd like to put a little distance between me and them.
Mm-hmm.
Could it be that that is what we are seeing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly could be. It certainly could be that the portrayal of Christianity and of Christians, and plenty of Christians who have, in actuality, fueled the fire for that, there's no doubt about it, have led them to that conclusion. Everybody who is a Christian has to, maybe this is getting us back to the transformational discussion about Lent, and I don't think Lent transforms you, but spiritual growth does lead to a conviction about what you know to be true. And there are things about my denomination that I'm not so sure are essential, and that there are some people that would argue are absolutely necessary, but there are other things that absolutely are. And that process of spiritual formation is up to the Holy Spirit. And I'm praying that for young people of all stripes that they'll find that transformation and get settled in their faith in Christ and their conviction that he is the way, the truth, and the life.
You know, I just pulled up Google, and I typed into the search engine the word sinner. The first option that comes up is sinners in the hands of an angry God.
There you go.
A famous sermon that was written by Jonathan Edwards, preached back in the 18th century, back actually in 1741. I think you got to work pretty hard to find a place or find a preacher that's going to preach a sermon like that these days. Actually, it seems to me, and you know, those who are listening to us, if you want to call and correct me and say, oh, no, Chuck, you're crazy, please do so. But it seems like we have a vacuum when it comes to the concept of hell. Now, we can talk about Christianity as a system of ethics and morality, telling us what's right and what's wrong. We can talk about Christianity from the standpoint of prosperity. We got all kinds of preachers who are willing to tell us how you can sort of use Christianity as a method to trigger good things in your life. But Christianity as a truth system, how you have eternal life and escape eternal death, that's like nowhere on the radar screen, it seems to me. Am I overstating it?
Yeah, and I think that the gift that Lutherans have historically had is that whole concept of the proper distinction of law and gospel. And if only everybody could get exposed to that and understand it and revel in it. But it takes you know, a considerable amount of time to really think that through and become comfortable with it. But once I wouldn't want to live in a culture that was dominated by Jonathan Edwards sermons either. I mean, that's been tried and is not the most pleasant.
Well, I think the key is balance, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. And that's where the proper distinction of law and gospel comes
in. So in a culture where there was no gospel, that would be bad.
That's right.
In a culture where there is no law preaching, that would be bad.
That's right. That's right.
It seems like we're apparently in the cycle where there's no law preaching.
Apparently, yeah. That's right. And a diversity of gospels with an S. And that's led to a lot of confusion.
So now let's not talk about your kids. I'm not going to pinpoint your kids. But
there
let's talk about our kids, those kids who are in their 20s now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think would happen if you came out? Well, let's not go as far as Jonathan Edwards here. He was pretty dramatic, pretty law, you know, the law and all of its wrath and fury there,
right.
Sinners in the hands of an angry God. What would you think would happen with your 20-year-olds if you came at them with that message?
That would be have the same effect as it would on me, too. I wouldn't like it. Too much law get me out of here. But if you use the law as a tool to expose the fact that none of us is perfect, and that, in fact, all of us have these inner feelings of insecurity and of worthlessness, really, like the psalmists express, I am a worm and no man and all that kind of stuff, then it's a very helpful experience. And I'll tell you what, I attended a funeral last week, and it was not in an LCMS congregation. The pastor, who happened to be a woman, did a wonderful job of using law and gospel to show that this is why people die. She used the law to show that. And brought the congregation to the fact that because we live in this fallen condition, though the pain of this death is enormous, the hope of everlasting life is absolute in Jesus Christ. I couldn't have been more thrilled with the way that was presented. And that's the way you do it. You use the law as a tool to rip apart our insecurities and our failings, how we all feel about ourselves, to expose that, but expose it skillfully so that the gospel is such a wonderful relief you will never want to let it go. And we've got some great preachers in this country who do a wonderful job of that. We need as many of them as we can get, and it's a difficult challenge in this environment to bring those messages to the people.
I guess I'm scratching my head because I'm thinking, you know, all the pastors we have here on the Bible study, I mean, there are just dozens of them.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I have always found to be most impressive, and I mean that in the kindest and best sense, is how consistent they all are when it comes to answering all the weird questions that I bring to the table. you would think that as screwball as some of the questions I ask, that the answers would just be all over the board, but they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my personal experience here. The answers, the doctrine, the teaching that is keeps coming back, no matter what kind of question I ask, is extraordinarily consistent, almost, dare I say, miraculously so.
Mm-hmm,
it's quite an impressive thing. However, I think if I were to say to any or all of those pastors who come to the Bible study, do you preach the law?
Mm-hmm.
I would bet my car that they would all say absolutely.
Right.
I can't imagine that any of them would say, no, I tend to leave that out.
Right.
However, could it be that there is a kind of proclamation of the law which, while maybe faithful to the scriptures, faithful to the task, is not arriving in the heads and the hearts of the people who are hearing it?
Mm-hmm.
It's arriving in such a way that it doesn't have impact, or it doesn't land. And if it doesn't land, then when the message of the gospel comes, that didn't land either.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't know, is it behind your question that are the preachers making people feel bad enough about themselves with the law? I don't know the answer to that.
I'm trying to understand how it is that we have come to this point in our church, I mean, in the American church, or in our culture, where we seem to feel pretty comfortable doing whatever we want. And I mean, you know, that's a broad expanse these days.
You bet.
We feel, you know, and if somebody is doing something that I believe is morally, ethically, or maybe ecclesiastically wrong, I'm not going to say anything about it. Because, you know, that's your thing, and you're not really hurting anybody, as far as I can tell. So I'm not going to speak a word, the law, against that. I don't want to do that.
Right.
So here we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems that that approach has produced a deterioration or a devolution, which is leading to a place that I don't think I want to go. But I don't know how to stop it or turn it around.
Well, that's another problem, how to stop it and turn it around. And basically, the only recourse, and I was thinking about this the other day, when we have all these terrible crimes. I mean, in St. Louis, you get up one murder after another. It seems like there's a murder du jour, and yet we can't have the Ten Commandments in the school, public schools, because it's too sectarian. There's a real essential part of that, but I look at the scriptures and try to see how law was properly or was constructively applied in people's lives, and often go back to the story of the prophet Nathan as he had to deal with David the king. Now, granted, he didn't have the luxury of being able to go in to see the king and boss him around and tell him you're a sinner in the hands of the angry God. But he did apply law, and he applied it very effectively. When he told the story of the man who had the one little sheep that he held on his lap and fed her from the little cup and was a, you know, called her by name and all this kind of stuff, and the man next door who had the 99, and the man with the 99 came and grabbed that little tiny sheep and butchered it and had it for dinner because he wasn't willing to give up one of his own. And, you know, David listened so intently to that preaching of the law, because the culmination of it was that man must pay, and Nathan, of course, said, "You are the man." You know, that's what the law has to do, and it has to be done one person at a time. As much as I love sermons and I think they're important, the application of the law and the relationship of bringing people to the Lord is a one at a time responsibility. And I, you know, it's tough and it's hard in this culture, which doesn't support that, to keep going. I salute the pastors and the faithful lay people who are trying to share their faith, but it is a reality that's tough to do in this culture we live in.
So, you would agree, I presume, that there will come a day which is just as real as this day is. You and I are fully engaged in the reality of this moment. And there is coming a day in the future where you and I will stand among all people,
right,
as the Lord of the universe separates the sheep from the goats.
Right.
And when that happens, the sheep will go into eternal life, the goats will go into eternal death, and this is a fact. Can I put it that way?
That is a fact.
Mm-hmm. So for those 20-year-olds or 50-year-old boomers like you and I are, who seem to be sort of oblivious to that, not really caring too much about it. What does that picture, how does that picture work on your mind and heart? Because if we believe that that is true, then we ought to be motivated to find an access point somewhere and get in there and
absolutely, and
do the deal, shouldn't we?
Absolutely, you bet. And it begins with looking down in my own soul and making sure that I understand that I am convicted of that. I don't do that every day because I'm comfortable with where I'm at. There was a time in my life, perhaps in yours as well, Chuck, where I had to work through all those questions myself. But the Lord has led me to a point where every single thing that you've just talked about, everything that's expressed in the Apostles' Creed, and ultimately everything that's in the Scriptures, is not only reality because I want it to be, it's reality because it is absolute truth.
So your faith has produced a peace in your life.
Exactly, yeah, and a settledness. And it hasn't also taken away the deep love and concern I have for all people and a desire that they come to know that as well. What I'm, what I wish I was better at, and I'm sure what you wish you were better at, is being able to share that with others and get them to receive it. And in that, we're the same as all the prophets who are in the Bible. All had that same frustration. How do I get this across? Can't seem to get it across. Or as a pastor once told me, or told me as recently as a couple of weeks ago, a sermon that he entitled, Why Bother? Was the sermon that he put together. We all have those feelings. We got to put them out of our minds and keep sharing as best we can.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm here to suggest that what we need is the next Jonathan Edwards.
Yeah.
Although, I'm holding that out as a possibility. But I do think that maybe a little bit more aggressive law preaching, the consequences of what will it be like when you're standing on that eternal shore and the Lord says to you, depart from me into everlasting condemnation, for I never knew you. We all ought to think that through.
You bet.
For ourselves and for our loved ones and all people. And I think maybe a relaxed approach to the law has produced or fueled a timidity in all of us that ought to be rethought.
Yeah, I think you're right. Of course, the other part of that parable is the fact that the sheep will be welcomed in, and the Lord will say, because I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was hungry, you fed me. I was in prison, you visited me. I was sick, and you comforted me. And they were surprised to hear that. And believe me, I will be surprised if he says that to me, because I don't think I do nearly enough of that.
Thank you, Tom. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Appreciate stay warm now. I've got to tell you that, because you know, might freeze again tonight.
That's right.
President Tom Reese, president of the Foundation of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, here on our Bible study program. And I have some administrative duties that I have to attend to tomorrow, so we're going to have Roland Lettner and Paul Clayton pinch hit again. They'll finish up Mark 16 tomorrow.
Listen to Chuck Rathert and guests Monday through Friday at the same time on the Bible study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.